The next lecture by Norman Foster is particularly interesting to all of us because there isn't anybody here that's going to escape dementia, be it in our patients, our family, or if we live long enough ourselves. And you all know this is a small world, and as I was talking to Dr. Foster, one of my best in childhood friends is Lonnie Wallen, who's one of the founders of the Alzheimer's Foundation. And so it's also a friend of Dr. Foster's. And he's my CPA lawyer just for doctors. And his expression is, if I can't deduct it, I can't afford it. So every time he comes to Utah to ski, I'm part of his deduction. And we go back. We were both born on the beaches of Brooklyn. So, you know, there's always a Utah connection all over. And now, to tell you something about Dr. Foster. He's a board-certified geriatric neurologist who has specialized in brain imaging and the dementing and neurodegenerative diseases for over 30 years. His research has focused primarily on brain imaging, clinical drug trials, and the clinical features and pathophysiology of degenerative disorders such as Alzheimer's disease and frontotemporal dementia. Dr. Foster's recent research focused on pragmatic studies to improve evaluation, diagnosis, and treatment of cognitive disorders. This includes the development and application of brain imaging, especially validating imaging in clinical care. Dr. Foster is professor of neurology, chief of the Division of Cognitive Neurology, Brain Institute senior investigator, and the director of the Center for Alzheimer's Care, Imaging, and Research at the University of Utah in Salt Lake. And he is a fellow of the American Academy of Neurology and American Neurological Association, and a chartered member of Alpha Omega, Alpha AOA, we all remember that in medical school. So, very delighted for our impressive and very humane next speaker.
Thank you very much. I need to find the advancer here. I don't see it. I have it. Thank you. Here it is. Well, thank you very much. I have the opportunity to give a lot of talks throughout the United States, and I have to say that I'm more honored by this than almost any other opportunity to speak because I don't know, I have not run across another general independent medical conference that is as well attended and as important as this conference. And, you know, so I just really applaud the Ogden community for having such an important conference. I want to make sure that you recognize the resources that are available through our center. We're the only place in the state of Utah that has board-certified geriatric neurologists, behavioral neurologist, geriatric psychiatrist, board-certified neuropsychologist, and we have a great team and provide services to try to advance the quality of dementia care in the Intermountain West. And so for individuals who have more difficult or complex dementing illnesses, then this is a resource that you should know about, and we invite you to utilize. So I've listed my potential conflicts of interest. We have support from many different sources in our center. And I want to talk about how my specialty has changed, an update in cognitive neurology. I'm going to discuss how biomarkers evolve in the course of Alzheimer's disease and how we've been able to use these biomarkers to increase our diagnostic accuracy and certainty, and how to incorporate these in the clinical diagnosis of patients with dementing disease. I'd like to have you go away recognizing the appropriate use of amyloid PET imaging and how to avoid pitfalls in its use, and know how ethical principles apply when trying to inform patients and family members about the results of amyloid PET results and the results of an evaluation. So I'm going to start with just some simple definitions that just remind you about some key facts. One of them is that cognitive complaints are not deficits. Most cognitive complaints don't deserve an evaluation because they are not associated with any significant change in cognition. And there are a number of ways that you can assess this. One of them is to identify whether there are any functional deficits that the patient has because of their cognitive problems. And if there is, then that is an important medical problem. The other is to identify whether they have a true deficit that goes along with their complaint. And you can do that in many different ways. One of the simple ways is what's called the mini-cog, asking three questions and then see if they can recall those after a five-minute delay or drawing the face of a clock. There are other things that are available, but your sense about knowing what this person has been like and whether there's a significant change or not is important to determine whether this is a reflection of a significant medical problem. Many people who are referred to us do have a memory problem, but it turns out to be due to attentional deficits. And in fact, in younger populations, people under age 70, this is probably the most common cause of a memory deficit, either medication side effects, difficulty with sleep, which decreases the efficiency of thinking ability. As you may know, several major psychiatric illnesses have cognitive impairments as a major diagnostic feature. For example, depression, one of the diagnostic criteria is impairment in thinking ability. Likewise with schizophrenia, so that's common. And of course, if someone has a serious medical illness, they can be distracted. Even if they don't have a delirium, they can be distracted and have difficulty with recall. Now, if a person with a complaint has no deficits, then you can reassure them, but you need to reassess because we're beginning to understand a lot more about people who have symptoms without any deficits, and they may be at particular risk for developing more problems. Now, as I go across the country, one of the most common questions that are asked both by lay audiences and by professional audiences is, what is the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease? So it's important that you know that dementia is a syndrome. So we can recognize the syndrome, but it's essential that we determine what the cause of that syndrome is. The prognosis management is completely different depending upon what disease or problem is causing a patient's difficulty. And dementia is defined as a decline in intellectual ability in two or more areas of thinking, two or more cognitive domains, sufficient to impair everyday activities. And this is not something that we can often assess very well in a hospital or an acute illness situation, but may have to defer when we are concerned about this to an outpatient evaluation of the patient's medically stable. And of course, the patient has to be alert, and we have to have some degree of cooperation to assess that. Now, as we've learned more about dementing diseases, we understand that they begin before patients have full-blown syndrome of dementia. And so there's this term that we're now using called mild cognitive impairment, which represents a situation in which a patient has a deficit, not just a complaint, but a deficit in two or more cognitive domains, such as memory, executive function, visual, spatial, language, and memory function. But these are insufficient to impair daily activities. Because these have different causes, the prognosis is variable. And in fact, in some settings, depending upon, for example, an epidemiologic setting, a substantial number of patients seen in follow-up will have no deficits. However, for those who finally get to a place like our cognitive disorders clinic, they've actually had to go through a number of different hurdles to get to us. And in our practice, as well with other academic dementia centers, the risk of developing progressive dementia is 10 to 15% per year, and it's cumulative. So this needs to be the basis of active surveillance and monitoring as well. Now, let me just say a few things so that we're all on the same base with Alzheimer's disease dementia. So Alzheimer's disease causes an insidious onset of gradual progressive memory problems without focal neurologic findings, without seizures, and without gait disturbance or incontinence until late in the disease. Memory loss is usually the first and most prominent symptom, and it continues to be the most prominent manifestation. Because memory is a bilateral brain function, we can distinguish it from just stroke, for example, which is very uncommon to affect both the hippocampus and both hemispheres that causes memory loss. In most cases, Alzheimer's disease is not inherited, but there is a familial predisposition. In about 10% of cases, this is actually an autosomal dominant disorder, usually when it begins earlier in life, before age 60. And in those cases, we actually know what some of the genetic mutations are and can identify them. Right now, we have ongoing research studies for such families, so it's important to identify those. Treatment studies, I should say. There are validated clinical diagnostic criteria which we can apply so we can be highly confident in the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. I hope you'll play along with me a little bit because I would like to have some participation in the audience. And I just want to remind you that the only failing grade is no vote. And so what I'd like you to do is think about this because we're going to follow up with some questions, and this will be pertinent to you and your practice. So the first question I have is whether, when you see a patient who has a chief complaint of memory loss, whether you believe that the major goal is to decide whether or not the patient is demented without determining the cause. Is the cause important or not? And or is your approach to determine the specific cause, even if it means additional testing to figure this out? So how many would say number one is your general approach right now? Okay. Very good. And how many would say number two? Yeah, very good. So as I've been giving, had the opportunity to give some talks throughout the country. In fact, I've actually been surprised that most primary care physicians report that they wish to determine the specific cause. That isn't necessarily, I think, the general feeling. In fact, you, as you may know, CMS and professional guidelines actually don't say that specifically. I'm fighting very hard to make that the rule, but it has not been a consensus that you should determine the cause. Now, the second, in your clinical practice, do you treat all patients with neurodegenerative dementia, things that like Alzheimer's disease or frontal temporal degeneration, Parkinson's disease with dementia, Lewy body with dementia, in the same way, irrespective of the cause, or do you find that determining the cause makes a difference in the way you treat those patients? So in those particular kinds of diseases, is there a difference? So how many would say that more or less everybody gets the same kind of treatment? And how many would say that different kinds of diseases have different kinds of treatment? Well, that's very helpful. Thank you so much for sharing that with me. As you'll see, it'll be relevant to what I'm saying in a little bit. Now, a third question, and this is a little more difficult. When you have a patient who has memory loss, and in which situations do you evaluate and manage that patient without ever involving a specialist? Is that the approach? Or do you tend to ask a specialist for an evaluation if you're uncertain about the cause? So how many would say, I feel comfortable handling these cases without a specialist? And how many would say, generally, you might seek a specialist? Thank you very much. That's helpful to know. As I go across the nation, my colleague Ed Zamorini and I have given a talk to a number of primary care physicians, hundreds actually by now, and it's about one-third will say the answer to the first and two-thirds the second. So there is a lot of variation across the country about this. So We believe, my colleagues and I, that the current approach to primary care cognitive evaluation is performing a history and examination, doing a cognitive assessment. This is often a screening test of some sort. Addressing depression, significant medical conditions, medication side effects when they could be identified. And of course, it's very important to identify those who have hearing loss or vision loss that may appear to be maybe misunderstood as a cognitive deficit. Do laboratory testing and structural brain imaging. And then if refer to a specialist early when the cause is uncertain in a particular case. So let me go on now after that introduction to talk about biomarkers that have now become available to help us with the evaluation of patients with dementing disease and how they've really changed the whole paradigm for at least specialist evaluation of dementia. But to remind you about Alzheimer's disease, it's caused by an abnormal accumulation of two proteins in the brain. Beta amyloid protein, which causes neuritic plaques here, a central amyloid core with neurite formation around it, and hyperphosphorylated tau protein, a structural protein within the cell, which causes neurofibrillary tangles. Now, we now know the clinical course of Alzheimer's disease. And it begins a number of years before any clinical symptoms appear. And we can now measure in patients who are alive A-beta protein, and there is amyloid accumulation in the brain 15 to 20 years before patients develop clinical symptoms. This appears to be followed by changes in tau protein and structural changes in the brain. That, again, can be identified often before there are any symptoms that develop. And as patients go through a phase of mild cognitive impairment, there always is structural change, both measured with structural MRI scans, as well as hypometabolism of cerebral glucose that can be measured by PET imaging. And then finally, there's progressive clinical changes that occur, with memory loss usually being the first. So we now think about establishing preventative treatments for Alzheimer's disease before dementia occurs, then disease-modifying therapies, and then symptomatic therapies, the ones that have been available through the FDA and have only modest benefits. Now, approximately 20% of all of you have Alzheimer's disease pathology in the brain. And we expect in the next 6 months or so to begin treating people who have normal cognition, who have amyloid in the brain, and therefore have presymptomatic Alzheimer's disease. So this is a big change in our thinking and the paradigm for treatment. Now, because of these biomarker advances, there's actually been a change in terminology that I hope you've kind of picked up on already, but they reflect new clinical criteria for Alzheimer's disease based upon these biomarkers. And the biomarkers actually are in two classes. One are the topographic markers that either are metabolic or have a change in the cortical thickness as neuronal loss and processes are lost in the disease, and molecular neuropathology that reflects the A-beta, status of A-beta, and hyperphosphorylated protein. Now, the FDG PET metabolism indicates that there are actually losses of synapses in particular areas of the brain that are distributed differently in different dementing diseases. And in fact, we're underusing the information on MRI scan. We haven't yet been able to convince, but we hope in the future to be able to convince other imaging centers in Utah to actually use quantitative biomarker quality brain MRI scans. And we can actually look at hippocampal volume and cerebral cortical volume and compare that with normal aging, because there are changes in these, to help us provide biomarker evidence of Alzheimer's disease or other conditions. With regard to molecular neuropathology, we can measure this either with spinal fluid measures or with what I'm going to tell you a little bit about today, amyloid PET measures. And within the past 6 months, we now appear to have validated tau measures. So we can measure both tau and amyloid with positron emission tomography. You'll be hearing much more about this, I think, as time goes on. Particularly exciting are the tau biomarkers. So with the new criteria, we now think about preclinical, asymptomatic Alzheimer's disease, those who have mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's disease, and finally, Alzheimer's disease dementia, which has been the class, the phase of this disease that we've often devoted our attention to. And of course, in order to be able to identify people who have preclinical Alzheimer's disease, we need to have biologic evidence of Alzheimer's disease pathology, either with imaging or with spinal fluid studies. I think more frequently we're going to see this with imaging studies. Now, the analogy that we like to make is that people have stroke due to atherosclerosis, and they may have atherosclerosis for a number of years before they have stroke or a heart attack. And so that we now use statin drugs to try to decrease the amount of atherosclerosis, and likewise in our strategies to treat Alzheimer's disease. Earlier, we are using the same analogy and beginning treatments to remove amyloid from the brain, and we can now monitor that with this kind of brain imaging technique. Now, we still have these classifications you may have heard about from the previous criteria that were published in 1984 of definite, requiring pathologic specimens to be absolutely certain of the presence of plaques and tangles, probable when there are typical features and there's very little uncertainty about diagnosis, possible when there are complex cases. Most common cause of dementia in people over age 75 is a combination of Alzheimer's disease pathology and vascular disease, for example. But for the first time, we now have criteria for not Alzheimer's disease. It's possible to exclude Alzheimer's disease pathology with negative biomarkers. So an advance in that way. And we can categorize biomarker probability of Alzheimer's disease pathology as you see here. So in our clinic, we try to give you all of that detailed information. So I'm going to now talk a little bit about amyloid PET because it requires some, it's a little difficult to use entirely on a clinical basis. And so there's some basic principles. We're using this because we get in vivo evidence of Alzheimer's disease pathology. And recently a third imaging agent has been approved by the FDA. You can see their names here, florbetapir, flutometamol, and florbetaben. The University of Utah produces flutometamol. We also do florbetapir imaging, having it shipped in right now from Denver, but we hope soon to be able to produce it here in Utah. And these are used both in clinical trials and research studies, but there are still barriers to its routine clinical use. It's reimbursed only by a few insurers. Most often this is now still self-pay, and it's being reimbursed by Medicare only in coverage with evidence development clinical trials, which we expect, again, in the next 6 to 12 months to begin using or performing here at the University of Utah. Now, the basis of the approval of these agents is that they reflect very accurately the amount of amyloid deposition in the brain at postmortem. So there was, so you'll see here, here's a negative scan. There is nonspecific binding in white matter. And this corresponds in the same patient, pathologically, no amyloid. Low likelihood of Alzheimer's disease pathologically. Intermediate amounts have intermediate amounts of amyloid, and high amounts have high binding of this radioactive isotope. And in the case of florbetapir, the results are actually required by the FDA to be shown in black and white. This is a negative scan. Here is a positive scan in which there's actually uptake in the cerebral cortex right out to the surface of the brain, because of course the beta amyloid and the neuritic plaques are in the cerebral cortex. Now, this is one of a number of studies, just to give you an idea about how these were validated. Autopsy results in 29 individuals were scanned. These were all expected deaths. And so they, patients and families, agreed to have a scan performed before an expected death. 52% of them had Alzheimer's disease pathology. And as you can see, there was a strong correlation between what the premorbid PET scan showed and the postmortem examination. In fact, there were no false positives with this agent. So the labeling of the fluorobetapir, and it's similar with the other two imaging agents, is that this is a test to estimate the beta amyloid neuritic plaque density in adult patients with cognitive impairments, not those who are not impaired, who are being evaluated for Alzheimer's disease or other causes of cognitive decline. And a negative scan has a great deal of power because we can exclude the possibility of Alzheimer's disease pathology. But in the case of a positive scan, this can also occur even though the Alzheimer's disease pathology may not account for symptoms. So it can be present in older people with normal cognition. So this is not a diagnostic test for Alzheimer's disease. It is a diagnostic test for Alzheimer's disease pathology. I should say Alzheimer's is not a diagnostic test for Alzheimer's disease dementia or mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's disease. It's a diagnostic test for Alzheimer's disease pathology. So here's an interesting question. No votes on this one, but the question is, which of these four patients who were scanned with amyloid PET have Alzheimer's disease? And in two of them, the scan is negative with mostly binding in the white matter. And in two, the binding is all the way out to the cerebral cortical margin and would be positive. And the answer, these are patients in our practice, the answer are that two of these individuals with dementia have negative scans, and yet they still have dementia. One is frontal temporal degeneration, the other dementia with Lewy bodies, neither of which have, in these particular cases, have amyloid or Alzheimer's disease pathology associated with them. Here's a person who's cognitively normal in the Alzheimer's disease neuroimaging initiative as a normal volunteer, and here's a patient who has depression. Now, whether these individuals will later develop a progressive dementia, we do not know. There hasn't been long enough time for follow-up. This is an illustration of how this is not a diagnostic test for Alzheimer's disease dementia or for dementia at all. So I was actually part of a committee to identify appropriate use of amyloid PET in clinical situations. And I want to review with you what we decided in these criteria that have been published. And we started out with a preamble. You have to have a complaint, but also objectively confirmed impairment. Secondly, Alzheimer's disease has to be a possibility, but there has to be some uncertainty about it. Otherwise, you don't need to have such a test to determine whether pathology is present. And it has to be in the context of a comprehensive evaluation by someone who is experienced in this kind of assessment. So you can see where our questions that I asked earlier are relevant. So these are uncertain. These are the atypical cases. And it has to be in a situation where there's knowledge, where knowledge of the presence or absence of amyloid pathology will really make a difference in the way we manage. So you can see if we decided at first that we were going to manage everybody with the dementing illness in the same way, there'd be no reason to do amyloid PET at all. Or if we were completely certain about what the cause was, we wouldn't need this. Now with those people who meet those preamble criteria, there are certain people who benefit from this kind of testing. Those in which there's an unexplained cause of mild cognitive impairment. Medication side effects, psychiatric illness, other kinds of things don't seem to be the explanation. In addition, those who have possible Alzheimer's disease, because there's a complexity in the situation or an atypical clinical course or unusual young onset of progressive dementia, these are the people who would benefit from this kind of testing. It would be inappropriate when there is no other conceivable explanation for their problems. They meet probable Alzheimer's disease criteria. It is not helpful in determining disease or dementia severity. As you can see, you could have mild dementia or moderate severe dementia. The scan may all look about the same. And it shouldn't be used just because there's a family history of problems. In fact, in some cases, that might be best done with genetic testing instead. In addition, if there is no deficit on examination, this is not appropriate. If there is non-medical indication, then it's not appropriate. So we came out and said, look, this is not for use by lawyers. It's not for use by employers. It's not for use by insurers. These are things that need to be considered. So let's apply some appropriate use criteria and see how this goes. So this is a patient of mine, 89-year-old, former executive. He began to notice gradual memory and thinking problems over the past 3 years. His wife also confirmed that she had noticed he had become forgetful. He was in excellent health. In fact, he was a very active skier, still skiing at age 89. He had had some hearing problems and had had a stapedectomy, but had not resolved his hearing problems. And the issue was that his daughter had emotional disability, and she was living in another town, and he was really providing her financial support. And he wanted to know whether he was going to need to plan for his own long-term care and disability. And so he went to his primary care physician, who found that he had memory deficits, and because of his age, apparently, thought that he had Alzheimer's disease. No other testing was done at that time. So, should he have an amyloid PET scan done? Again, time to vote. How many people think that would be appropriate by the appropriate use criteria? So there are a couple here. I should have mentioned that he's an executive. He can pay for this easily. He's got plenty of money. He's got his own chalet and all that stuff, okay? How many think it would be inappropriate? So most people think it's inappropriate, and in fact, I think it's inappropriate. His evaluation hasn't been complete. We haven't considered other possibilities. So even if he had a positive scan, I wouldn't know whether it was related to his symptoms or not. So let's continue with this little story. So he was unsatisfied with the answer given by his primary care physician. He wasn't convinced that the doctor really knew what his problems were. So he asked for a referral to a neurologist. The neurologist's exam showed that he had difficulty with word recall, but no functional deficits or difficulty with clock drawing. He had hearing problems. He got brain imaging and blood tests, which were normal. And he made a diagnosis of amnestic mild cognitive impairment. The patient said, "Doctor, I'm interested in whether I'm going to get worse over time. Do I have Alzheimer's disease pathology?" So how many people at this point think that it would be appropriate for the neurologist to order an amyloid PET scan? Appropriate, there's some people here. And how many people think it's inappropriate? Good, thank you, and I appreciate everybody voting. But if you watched very closely, this would be categorized by criteria as inappropriate because a dementia specialist was not involved. And as a dementia specialist, I actually think his evaluation was incomplete. So he finally comes up to me. He gets referred to the dementia specialist at the university. And you can see here that I got a little different history. What he said is that when he and his wife have a bunch of family friends over Their cocktail party and so on, that he can't keep up with what other people are saying. And he admits that he's been irritable and had some mood problems lately. His wife confirms that. On exam, he has some language deficits during conversation with verbal recall, but I recommended some additional testing. Again, there was no difficulty with clock drawing, visual spatial abilities, no functional impairment. So mild cognitive impairment was a possibility, but I recommended neuropsychological testing, and I wanted to know how bad his hearing really was. Did that account for his difficulty with verbal recall? And he got mad at me. He said, "Look, doc, you are the third doctor you've seen. I've been on the internet. I've read about the definitive test. Is a spinal fluid examination or amyloid PET? I don't want to waste any more of my time or your time. No more money wasting. Give me the diagnostic test." And so he demanded one of that. He was this kind of executive who was used to getting his way. He thought he would get his way. And so he says, "Doc, I've got plenty of money. I need this test. Should I get the test? Is it appropriate? He can pay for it himself. Inappropriate? A little more uncertainty here, but still inappropriate, and I thought not. Deficits had not been objectively defined. So the outcome is that we did get audiogram and audiology. He couldn't get the test except through me, so I really had some leverage on him. So it showed that he had had severe hearing loss, and it had progressed over the past 2 years. He was really not hearing. Misunderstanding a lot of things that people were saying. And neuropsychological testing was remarkable. It showed superior performance. His IQ was 130 or so, average being 100. Even his memory quotients were superior when it was given to him in a way that he could understand it. And he did have borderline mood problems, perhaps understandable. So my diagnosis was no cognitive deficits were present, and I recommended auditory rehabilitation. And the lesson is that at age 89, it's fairly likely that he would have had Alzheimer's disease pathology in the brain, but it would have led to an incorrect prognosis and management. Well, let's talk a little bit about the ethics of this, because as we've been using clinical amyloid PET, we've come to recognize that this is a lot like genetic testing. I have to say that I've become very surprised. Patients I've been following for 2 or 3 years told them they have Alzheimer's disease dementia, and then because they're part of a research study that we're doing, they got a clinical amyloid PET. And when I told them that they had a positive scan, both the patients and the caregivers really, to my surprise, were taken aback. I explain the basis of my diagnosis and how certain I am, but somehow having a physical scan put in front of them that's positive really takes out all the uncertainty and perhaps sometimes the uncertainty that they have been holding on to. And their hopes. So it's important to adopt a pre-test, post-test model of education and disclosure, just as when we do a causative a genetic test. So disclose the limits of the test and its clinical value, assess the motivations for why they are getting such a scan, determine what potential discrimination that they and their family may experience by knowing that there's Alzheimer's disease, and how this might have implications for employability and insurance, because our laws do not protect people who have preclinical disease. And then afterwards, it's important to present these results to the patient with someone else present, a family member, I would say. Just calling somebody up, and in fact, the problem we have with our own electronic medical records, it's sometimes these results are released to families without an opportunity for me to put them in perspective, to provide this kind of pre-post-test counseling. So beware of that. But it's important in making a diagnosis, to discuss prognosis, and also to plan for support. Let me just give you a few cases here. One is an 80-year-old former executive began to notice memory problems over the past 3 years and wanted to have an amyloid PET scan without other testing. Let's see if which you think is best. What is the appropriate next step? Should we order the scan if he can pay for it, observing the ethical principles of autonomy? Should we observe the principle that we should refuse to order the scan until other testing has been completed, which is number two? Number three, begin treatment with a cholinesterase inhibitor to see if he symptomatically improves before ordering an amyloid PET scan. Or finally, if his wife confirms that she has noticed memory loss because of his age, he almost certainly has Alzheimer's, and an amyloid PET scan wouldn't be needed. So another vote, after we thought about those, how many would say number one, that we need to follow the principle of autonomy? Number two, refuse until, this is a difficult one to do in practice, okay? Three, begin symptomatic treatment, see if he improves. A couple of people would do that. The problem is knowing whether somebody's improving or has been more stable than expected. And then almost certainly has Alzheimer's disease. So we all have some uncertainty about this. So I'm with you. Gee, we're right on. Let's try a different one. 60-year-old woman brings in a report of a positive amyloid PET scan she's received. Now, it's not true here in Utah, to my knowledge, but actually, in several parts of the country, you can go to a mall, a shopping mall, and get an amyloid scan if you pay money on the barrel head. So this is not an unreasonable scenario here. She has no symptoms, continues to work. On examination, she has no objective cognitive deficits. Which of the following is true? Number one, the amyloid PET scan probably hasn't been interpreted correctly. Number two, the patient should receive an EEG and a brain MRI scan. Number three, the patient has preclinical Alzheimer's disease. Or number four, the scan should be repeated every 2 years until she develops dementia. Okay, so number one, do you think that's not been interpreted correctly? She's cognitively normal. A few people think that that's probably the answer. Number two, the patient should receive an EEG. Any neurologists here in the audience? I think EEG and brain MRI. Patient has preclinical Alzheimer's disease, dementia, Alzheimer's disease. So fewer, more of those. The scan should be repeated every 2 years. Nobody wants to do that, I don't think. Okay, so the answer here is that the patient has preclinical Alzheimer's disease. Now, it's possible to misinterpret that a radiologist would misinterpret the scan results. And I have to say that I'm not so certain in the shopping mall how good the quality is. There are training sessions for radiologists so that they do this accurately, but that is not enforced, to my knowledge, by CMS, even though it's required. Now, the final one, 58-year-old woman developed progressive language difficulty over the past 2 years. She's independent in personal care, but no longer can cook. So she has an impairment in functional abilities. The appropriate approach to report amyloid PET results is require the patient to bring a friend or family member and meet with you in person. Number two, have a staff member call the patient's family with the results and a prescription based upon the scan result. Number three, because of HIPAA guidelines, the only person we can really tell the results to is the patient, unless there's a signed response. Actually had that happen. Number four, before providing results, send the patient to a social worker or psychiatrist to make sure the patient will not become depressed or suicidal when hearing the results. How many would say number one? Okay, number two? Number three? Ooh, everybody, there's a few people who are not voting. And number four. So, the answer is correct, number one, as we discussed. It's important to have somebody there. So I want to I have spent this time talking about how the paradigm for evaluation of cognitive impairment has changed. And unfortunately, I don't have time to talk about how the paradigm for management of dementing diseases has changed. So let me just give you a preview of what that's about. So we now know that it's possible to identify cognitive problems earlier. And one of the ways that this is done is through the Medicare benefit, the new Medicare benefit called the annual wellness visit, which requires an assessment of cognition. And in that way, it's possible to identify deficits early and initiate an evaluation. And at Salt Lake IHC and University Healthcare, over the next year, we're going to be initiating a standardized way. We're going to be doing a trial about whether early referral to a multidisciplinary dementia clinic like ours improves care versus the care that's provided without specialist assistance. Once they come to a specialty clinic like ours, we emphasize three different kinds of principles. One is precision care. We want to tailor treatments to an individual's characteristics and to their individual situation. So not everybody gets the same care. We need to know exactly what the cause is and what the situation is. Second is proactive care. For those of you who referred patients to our clinic, you may have heard about this. What we're trying to do is intervene to prevent crises and complications before they occur, rather than reactive care, where we're often just taking calls and trying to respond to the challenges when they come up. So we can identify foreseeable complications and get families prepared to manage this illness on their own. And then finally, the most recent is individually sculpted care. We recognize that many behavioral complications occur when the patient's care setting is insufficient to meet their needs. So people who are no longer able to live alone are being asked to live alone. Or people who have no supervision at night have sleep disruption because they're really not capable of doing that. So matching, determining what an individual patient's strengths and weaknesses are, and then compensating for those, sculpting care and changing the care as disease progresses are among the new paradigms for how we change cognitive care. Well, I appreciate everyone's participation and voting. I know sometimes it's kind of embarrassing to do, but you've done a great job, and I appreciate your attention. Thank you very much. I tried to arrange for a few minutes to answer questions or comments that you may have. Yes. So the question is whether, if you have Alzheimer pathology, amyloid pathology, for example, does that always lead to a progressive dementing disease? And so this is a little bit of semantics that we have some difficulty with. If under these new criteria, if you have amyloid in the brain, then you have Alzheimer's disease. But we do not know whether that means you will always develop progressive dementia. If you have atherosclerosis of the coronary arteries, you do not always get heart attack, right? So we frequently find people who haven't had any symptomatic heart disease, they often will have significant coronary atherosclerosis at postmortem. There are two theories in the field about this, and I have to say that I'm on the minority position. I actually think that there are some people who are resilient and who are able to compensate for Alzheimer pathology without developing progressive dementia. Many of my colleagues believe that ultimately, if someone lives long enough, if they have amyloid pathology, that they will develop Alzheimer's disease, and we don't know the answer to that. We now have about 3 years of follow-up for people who are cognitively normal and who've been found to have amyloid pathology. We know that they're at increased risk, but it certainly isn't 100%. What happens at 10 years, we're not so sure. I should say that one of the reasons we know both about the evolution of these biomarkers with disease and also how long people can have these biomarkers without symptoms is based upon an important study at Washington University called the DIAN study, Dominantly Inherited Alzheimer Network, D-I-A-N. And they, because if you inherit a gene mutation that always causes Alzheimer's disease, we not only know that that will always cause Alzheimer's disease if you survive, but we also know at what age you will develop symptoms. And so these people are being tested beginning about age 18 and getting serial testing of these biomarkers, and we know exactly then when they will get dementia and when the biomarkers appear. So a lot of interesting information. Yes? This is a very important question. The question is, what do we do when somebody says, I have a history of dementia in my family, and what is my risk? And the first thing to do is figure out what that history is. So it's a little different if there have been three family members who have autopsy-confirmed Alzheimer's disease pathology after death, and that there's an autosomal dominant pattern of inheritance from someone I saw recently who said there's Alzheimer's disease in my family. The patient had never been evaluated for the cause of their problem, and it was an aunt who was age 80 and the patient was age 55. So one of the things that, so knowing what this history is, in our clinic we're now using a standard, assignment of the likelihood of familiality called the Goldman Scale of Familiality, so that can help. We're happy to help with that. But often we can reassure patients. In fact, one of the big issues here in Utah is making sure that if there's a family history of dementia, that there be evaluation and that patients and their families have access to postmortem diagnostic services, because right now this generation doesn't have a lot of information that's very accurate about the previous generation. The other thing I would say that can be extremely helpful is, when did it affect other family members? So if it's familial, if it's a mutation, we know that sometimes it will affect families at age 40, others at age 50, 60, and so on. It's much more likely to be sporadic and non-familial if it affected somebody in their 80s. But it's very confusing, I agree, and we're happy to hear about them. We can answer your questions. Well, we can talk about the treatment for Alzheimer's disease. We can decrease the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease with a regular exercise plan of 20 minutes daily of physical exercise. Keeping mentally active and socially engaged has been shown to decrease the risk of Alzheimer's disease in those who are family members, those who have a family risk. We also now have treatments available for people who, as I mentioned, who are asymptomatic, who are at high risk. The population in Utah that's at highest risk are minority populations, Hispanic and African Americans, and they are particularly relevant to have testing to see if they have Alzheimer's disease pathology and begin treatment. What we're using is solanezumab, which is a drug that removes amyloid through an immunotherapy. And so I can't tell you that that's proven yet, but we know that we can cure mouse Alzheimer's disease, and also that we can remove beta amyloid. The question is when, how much needs to be done to be successful. And then, of course, there are FDA-approved treatments, two classes of drugs that are approved for Alzheimer's disease if they have dementia already. So I think that the idea that there are no treatments for Alzheimer's disease or other dementias is really outdated. I have to admit they're no more effective than many other treatments for chronic disease. We did not have a cure. We're hoping for a cure, but I think we will get disease-modifying treatments ahead of time. And there are major things that can be done. One of the stories I like to tell is when we were beginning trials with cholinesterase inhibitors for Alzheimer's disease, and patients in the trial in the placebo group actually did significantly better than those historically had done. And it turns out that the historic sample size determinations were based upon people who were at the Bronx VA hospital in an inpatient unit where the usual treatment was a day treatment in a wheelchair, often restrained. Those people do much worse than patients in our practices do these days. So there are significant things that we can accomplish. So I'm out of time, and I appreciate all of your attention, and thank you very much.